You're listening to the podcast of the musictherapyresearchblog.com. Very special guest for this edition of the Music Therapy Research Podcast. Today I have Bill Matney. He's, it's a little bit self-serving, I guess, because Bill's somebody that I've known for a while now and a co-author on a couple papers that we have written and published about percussion pedagogy and the use of percussion in clinical music therapy situations. And so besides having percussion in common, we also have our sort of interest in research and researching music therapy, of course, also in common. Bill is a doctoral student at the University of Kansas, one of the foremost universities in terms of doctoral level talent, and I think he's a little bit unusual in the sense that he already has publications as a doctoral student. That's not as common a thing in our field in music therapy, for sure. So I thought I'd get him on the podcast to talk a little bit about research and percussion, but also a little bit about what got him into the situation he's in right now. Not that you'd want to call a doctoral degree a situation, but what were his research stirrings as a master's student, when, you know, how did he sort of get the bug? What he's into now, what he thinks he could be into, what he wants to do with the PhD down the line, and all that as well. So I think Bill's a real interesting guy. I think he's really articulate. I love listening to him go through sort of his thought processes, especially as it relates to research, especially as it relates to percussion and percussion pedagogy, and certainly a little bit of a project that he's working on that is really important to him, music therapy drumming. And information you can find out on the blog post that has links to music therapy drumming, and also to a book that is something that came out of his master's research, which was a content analysis of the uses of percussion in music therapy. I think that book is a really valuable part of percussion pedagogy and music therapy. It's called Tataku, The Use of Percussion in Music Therapy, out of Sarsen Publishing. And I'll, again, have a link on the blog. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy this podcast, podcast number 3, with Bill Matney.
There's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these days.
Bill, thanks for giving me a little bit of your time to be on the on our research podcast here. So you're a researcher, right? Have you ever introduced yourself and said, "Hi, Bill Matney, researcher extraordinaire"?
No, I've not used that phrase.
No, you're gonna wait till after the PhD to do it.
Maybe so. You know, maybe burgeoning researcher feels a little more comfortable for me at this time. But
I'll look forward to seeing that on your email signature, right, Bill Matney, Esquire, burgeoning researcher.
Burgeoning researcher.
Well, I was talking with Blythe about this sort of thing, and she's got the Twitter biography that says "an excited new researcher," and I'm like, Blythe, you know, you're associate professor now, you're tenured and promoted at a major research university, you've got several, you know, peer-reviewed articles, invited articles, and that sort of thing. When do you take the new part about it being about excited researcher? Not that you want to be excited old researcher, but. So I was teasing her about the biography stuff. So I'm glad you've put some thought into it. So so things are going pretty well for you at KU. You've decided to pursue this PhD at Kansas. And maybe back up to the start here. Is there a point that you really started recognizing that you? I don't know what I want to say, have an affinity for research or reading it, or that you wanted to conduct some of your own? Do you recall, or was there a professor or somebody that comes to mind and sort of nurtured you, guided you along that path?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I would say my interest in research began at the undergraduate level. Of course, at that time, I wasn't conducting research. At the graduate level, I certainly began conducting research and exploring research processes in order to better understand them and hopefully eventually be able to publish. So I'll tell you a probably much longer story than you want to hear, but I'm going to do it anyways.
Oh, I'm excited now. Great.
Are you? Good. Well, I'm glad that the long drawn out introduction is exciting, scintillating perhaps. So Dr. Nikki Cohen was my advisor at Texas Woman University when I was working on my master's, and I had this pretty solid idea of what I wanted to do for my graduate thesis, and I was interested in conducting improvisation and seeing what the effects of improvisation were on clients diagnosed with various addictions, and was actually interested in doing a phenomenological analysis of that, dealing with the essence of their experience.
And as an undergraduate?
No, as a master's student.
Oh, the master's student at TWU. Yeah. Okay.
So that was my first interest in a thesis, and I'm sure I'm not alone in the experience of having a thesis idea that was solidifying kind of fall out from under me. I had a great committee with a well-established qualitative researcher who I took a class with, and I had a setting, the VA hospital that I did my internship at, as a plausible site. And then within the matter of about 3 months, I got notification that that particular VA medical center may shut down, and it never did. But that kind of threat, of course, is enough to make you reconsider what you're going to do.
When you just want that sheet of paper, when you got to have that master's degree in hand, any yes. little road bumps.
Right? Yes. Yes. That process versus product kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So on top of that, the qualitative researcher who I studied with ended up having to leave the university, and she wrote me this wonderful letter, but it changed everything. And so I go in to speak with my advisor after both of these things popped up, and I said, we're back to square one. What do I do? And her response was quite succinct and incredibly apropos. It was, why don't you do what you already do, which is study, discuss the use of percussion in therapy. I had already had the opportunity to teach a course on that as an undergraduate student and start understanding how to teach. And her suggestion was to do a content analysis and then create a manual based on the literature that I had read to help instruct music therapists and music therapy students how to better use the instrumentation for therapeutic reasons. So that started me off. And it's certainly been a line that I have continued to this day.
One of the things that we end up talking a little bit about on this particular podcast are barriers that clinicians and, you know, graduate students certainly have in terms of pursuing research. So I'm wondering, you know, when you were talking about this with the people at TWU, I mean, I think everyone sort of goes into a master's degree knowing, even if it's not a necessarily a research university, or if there's different tracks and people sometimes, well, this is a thesis track, this is a senior project or a final project track or something, you know, depending on whatever the semantics are about it, they know they've got some big monster waiting for them at the end of the line. And that right. monster is usually something that's based in research. So I wonder, you know, even though this thing was sitting there the whole time, what was that like for you? Do you remember feeling like, oh man, a content analysis? I don't even know what that is. Or that sounds like enormous. Or yes, I know I'm going to make millions of dollars selling my book, Tata Ku, but can I really afford to spend all my time doing this when, again, I need to have a product? I need to have that master's degree. I just want to wrap that up. I don't want to spend 2 years doing this content analysis, even though it sounds great.
Yes. Well, yeah, I tend to be a very, at times, you can probably attest to this, a rather big picture thinker. And I like to really get into lots of details and take my time getting everything together and then hopefully coming up with a particular result at the end. I like to be deliberate and thorough, and I learned very quickly in this situation that if I wanted to graduate in a reasonable period of time, that we needed to take things easy. So Dr. Cohen and I very much discussed the types of delimitations that would make it a plausible study for me, and that included looking at about 20 years of the literature, the most recent literature. So that certainly helped. I was also very passionate about the topic, and I think that's a huge point that needs to be made. Being passionate about the topic meant that I had no problem spending, you know, 4 to 8 hours a day working on it, because I was so fascinated by it that the time was easily spent and I was able to move through it quickly.
And it's still it's still something that I wonder, when you look back on it, what do you think is another one of your big takeaways? I'm sure one of the big takeaways is be passionate about whatever you're doing, because there's a chance you could have spent 4 to 8 hours a day, you know, looking at phenomenological analysis and really digging into addictions and that sort of thing that you were mentioning before. But do you have maybe one or two other sort of major takeaways, given that this was, I assume this was sort of like your big introduction to being a researcher?
Yeah, well, you know, I keep referring to Dr. Cohen. She was such a wonderful mentor. But I mean, one of the things she quickly told me also, because I think every single one of us that goes into a master's degree or a PhD, you know, we want to change ourselves and we want to change the world and we want to do huge things. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves that it's just a thesis and it's just a dissertation. And not to belittle either of those things, they are huge projects, but we can also see stepping stones to the larger outcome that we want, which is absolutely what has occurred. I mean, my study of that creation of the content analysis at that point in time has allowed me to further that line of research and collaborate with you and collaborate with Stephanie Scheffel and keep those ideas moving forward. And now to be able to have some of those ideas published and communicated to the field, and hopefully making some changes in terms of percussion training and the way we perceive percussion being used in clinical practice, I think.
When did you know that? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying in both cases, I think that's been important to me to see something as a stepping stone and then to move it forward.
When did you know that you wanted to not necessarily go to KU, but when did you feel like, I'm going to make that next step, not just a doctorate, but specifically a doctorate at a pretty intensive research university?
Yeah, great question. I, you know, had thought about doing a PhD for a while, and I had thought about quite a few of the larger schools. I had thought about NYU at one point. I had thought about Temple at one point, based on particular interests at particular times. Had an opportunity to visit NYU at one point, just kind of in passing, happened to be in the city and enjoyed my time there. Mm-hmm. The impetus for coming to KU pretty much occurred through a colleague, Dr. Gadberry, Anita Gadberry. She was at KU at the time and invited me to come up and visit, but she kind of had ulterior motives. And was kind of interested in seeing if I was recruitable. And so I came up and really enjoyed my time.
She hands you the Jayhawk hat and the accompanying scarf and the embroidered jacket with Rock Chalk written on the back of it. And
And we
assume you go from there.
Shot some hoops.
Yeah, yeah, great tickets. Tickets to you know, to a KU Jayhawk basketball game. Sure, that makes sense. Of course, they cover up Naismith Drive and they call it Matney Drive just for the day, just for the 2 hours that you're visiting.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Wow, because, wine and dine like you're a blue chip football player. That's pretty great.
It is. It's a great recruitment process.
Actually getting into KU and everything, and what you're doing now. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you've gone this far, and you are in sort of the percussion area, and you've also talked a little bit more about some other aspects of music therapy and I'll let you talk about it. But what do you see as sort of your current doctoral focus, whether it's in or outside of percussion studies?
So, yeah, you know, I there's only so, obviously, as you can understand, there's only so much that I can tip my hat towards, given that some of these papers that I'm working on are not yet published. But I have not only a large interest in furthering percussion study and furthering the understanding of how we use percussion in music therapy and why we do so, I'm also... And I've always been this way. I mean, pretty much every publication that I have at this juncture has been a collaborative process. Having the opportunity to work with you and with Stephanie, and you look in Tataku and there's tons of collaboration, and the music therapy drumming team is a collaborative team. I'm very interested in collaborative research, and I'm interested in the philosophy behind collaborative research and ways to look at music therapy as an interdisciplinary and a transdisciplinary process. So that's something I've been exploring. I'm currently taking a wonderful class called Design Thinking, and I'm really enjoying learning about the collaborative process and learning about it through this particular lens.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about music therapy drumming. Obviously, I'm a drummer and I like that, but I'm also an educator, and I think I can speak for both of us when I say I think we both recognize how important percussion is for clinical uses of music therapy, and I think we'd also both agree, and we found in our research that percussion is definitely something that should be emphasized more in the undergraduate, graduate curricula. And I think what you guys are doing with music therapy drumming is really just trying to give people a lot of, and I wonder if you hear this too, a lot of, oh man, I wish I would have had this when I was an undergraduate. I wish I would have had these patterns. I wish I would have had this direct applicability instead of, learning how to tune a bass drum and having to buy timpani mallets and that sort of thing. But I also think that the valuable part about music therapy drumming is that you provide that research backbone for the team. Not to say the other three people on your team aren't doing research or aren't digesting it and aren't sort of thinking about it more, but they're definitely coming at it from more of a clinical angle, and you're really providing the research backbone for it. Maybe talk a little bit about music therapy drumming in terms of how you designed the program, how you used research to be functional to create this program.
Yes, absolutely. I'll kind of preface a little bit. I think about the collaborative process between, Kalani and Carolyn Keeble and Mike Marchinetti and I. And, in a collaborative process, everybody takes not a role that's only theirs. Everybody shares, but people tend to find a particular role that works best for them. And I could probably spend 30 minutes talking about how I perceive each person's role in the group, and I think it's quite perceptive of you to pick up on the research side of things and how perhaps that's been a contribution that I've offered. One of the things that I've really focused on just in general, and I think it's plugged in well to music therapy drumming, are particular considerations with the way we think about the use of percussion in music therapy. And there are some focuses that, or foci, sorry, I should use the right word.
Yeah, come on, researcher.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. That you and I discussed in our article, the first article that you and I put together in Perspectives, that music therapy drumming really gets into, where we're talking about particular instrumentarium skills, knowing – what instrument you're playing, knowing where it came from, being able to communicate those particular things, as well as communicate how to play in both traditional and creative ways, in simple ways for clients, and then being able to back those up with music skills, being able to lead a group with those instruments, and then being able to understand the salient considerations of each instrument in terms of their therapeutic functions and their therapeutic applications. And that was something that you and I discussed in our initial article. It was something that I looked at in my initial content analysis. It's something that the JMT article, the survey discusses and gleans more detail from clinicians about. And you and I discuss a little bit in the New Perspectives article on pedagogy and survey with educators. And when we get this information, we're able to say, here's what clinicians want and need. Here is the information that they're telling us in terms of what they use. And we can take all of this and plug it in to a training program and make things hopefully as relevant as possible to their work. And based on the feedback that we've gotten, that's been the case. You know, ultimately, and you said this once to me, and I thought it was well said, ultimately, what we would like is to see that the universities pick this up and we work ourselves out of a gig.
Right. The idea of the self-defeating purpose. Like, I want to work really hard so that I don't have to work really hard
anymore.
Let me go back to some of this point about KU again, because you're mentioning a little bit about the publications. You know, in our field, it's number one, it's rare. You know, whatever PhDs are in our field, I think, if I'm recalling right, it's like maybe like 2 or 3% of our total field has the PhD. The idea that people are working towards a doctoral degree and they already have publications under their belt is really unusual. It's, you know, it's quite a feather in your cap. I'm wondering, for those potential master's degree students, current or let's not even say current, but they're thinking about master's, or maybe they haven't necessarily had the experiences you and I had, where people were encouraging us to keep on moving forward with research, and they're kind of on their own and maybe doing their clinical thing, but maybe this was always in the back of their mind. You've been publishing before you even have the PhD after your name. I'm wondering what sort of insider advice you might offer to somebody who might come to you and say, I want to get involved. I'd love to be a published author, but I what am I supposed to do? How did you get started? What's the lead here?
Yeah. So, just as a few examples, I'm working with various clinicians right now. In some cases, reviewing articles that they're writing. In some cases, collaborating with them because of their particular strengths and my particular strengths on a particular topic, and we're writing together. In that way, these are not PhD students. I don't think they have any intention of even getting their PhD. These happen to be people with their master's degrees. And I think we're going to be seeing, hopefully, you know, I guess I'm being a little idealistic, but hopefully more clinicians interested in putting out clinical research that perhaps is supported by people working on their PhDs or people with PhDs, and we see that type of collaborative process. I would recommend that people who are interested in putting out research find somebody that's interested in working with you. And if that's a PhD student or if that's a professor at a university, take the opportunity to find people that you connect with and have perhaps similar interests and make something happen. I think that's one of the biggest things to do. And if you feel that you're not as strong in your writing or your understanding of a particular methodology or even which methodology to choose, if you're working with someone who has skills in those areas, you might find the process much easier. Based on my knowledge of where Perspectives is right now, I believe that they're encouraging this type of clinician researcher collaboration. And I'm not separating those two entirely, that one person is a clinician and one is a researcher, and there's no doubling of the two, but some people might feel more comfortable in one area or the other. So I think that that type of collaborative process would certainly be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. So take a hypothetical walk with me into the future now, Dr. Matney. So you've got the PhD, you've established yourself at a position of repute, and not ill repute. I just said repute.
Good.
I just want to be clear that that's on the recording. I'm sure you'll have some things that are ongoing. You know, nobody ever sort of leaves a project entirely behind, but you get to start a project from the beginning. And regardless of the topic that you'd pick, maybe give listeners a sense of your research process. Where do you start in terms of conceptualizing an entire research project, all the way something that you're thinking, as a new PhD, I want to move forward and I want to get this thing published. Here's the project. How do you conceptualize your beginning to that process?
Yeah, so you know that's certainly not so far-fetched, given that I'm beginning my dissertation process at this point. Mm-hmm. A little early. I'm hopefully defending my comprehensive here soon. So
the answer is always Altshuler for your comprehensive exams. Altshuler will always be an answer. So just
Altshuler.
I just write it down. I gave you one of the answers. Don't tell Dr. Colwell I did it.
I appreciate that. That's good. Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with that name a little bit. So, the first thing that I do, if there's a topic of interest, I can be a big picture thinker that likes to dig into tons of details. If I'm interested in a particular topic, one thing I'm going to do is I'm deciding on what my specific research question is going to be, is I'm going to dig into the literature. And I'm not just talking about a standard literature review. I'm going to have a set of questions that pop up because I'm looking at the literature at large. And I'm going to be looking at that. If I'm looking at a particular article, I'm going to pull into the back of it and look at who's cited the most, why they're cited in that particular article. And I'm going to see if I want to go visit that as well. So I will backtrack through the particular studies that have been used. And I'm going to have a whole set of questions at that point. Now, at some point, I've got to focus that question more. And this is one of my personal challenges. Sometimes I can make things a little too big. But by knowing more details, I think oftentimes it helps me to comprehend what's going on. And then I'm able to focus onto a particular question.
What about the logistics? That's a great philosophical background. Logistically, people have different senses of how to go about this. People say, well, I'm at a research university and I'm going to have a protected research day. And clinicians go, I don't have a protected research day. When am I supposed to do research? When am I supposed to read? When am I supposed to not see clients and do other things? Do you see yourself, maybe you're having to do an awful lot of time management now, but certainly research is definitely part of sort of your job description at this point. Logistically, how do you prioritize the time to research and is it ever sort of a concern that you're not dedicating enough time, because it's a heavier time of year, because there's coursework and stuff involved, or is there something that do you try to carve out this many minutes a day or a week, or what's your process?
Yeah. I know that some people do really look to carve out particular times in their day. That's not something, honestly, that I've done as much. I tend to approach things in a very proactive sense, in that if I see a particular communication that needs to be addressed at a particular time, I deal with it immediately and quickly, and then I get back to juggling the other balls that I'm juggling. So I personally take a very proactive approach, and I deal with things in the moment, and that works for me so far. Whether that will work for me later or not, I do not know. But at this point in time, I'm obviously juggling balls where I'm teaching a guitar class this semester and navigating that with students, and I'm supervising students and getting their assignments in. And right now I'm a little behind on that, and I'm aware of that. I've just taken care of getting in papers for a defense here soon. So that large ball has been juggled and passed on. And I just do my best to be incredibly proactive with everything. I think for some people, it behooves them to say, okay, from, you know, 3 to 5 on this day, this is what I'm going to do. I'm dedicated to it. The phone goes off. I don't look at emails. It just hasn't been the case for me that I've needed to do that.
Right. I like the big concept of proactivity. I also like the idea of that's what works for me right now. Mm-hmm. Let's not get bogged down in, well, geez, is this going to be the next 40 years of my life are going to be like this? No, there's ebbs and flows, and you never know where you're going to be a year from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now, and you're not quite sure how things are going to work. Let me wrap up with this, and I appreciate you hanging out for this podcast and giving so much time and ideas to it. So the last thing I want to ask you is, let's say you're giving the keynote at next month's AMTA conference, and the theme is go forth and do research. Give me a little bit of your be a cheerleader for why people should get involved with research. How would you want to talk to our profession? What would you want to say to our profession as a whole in terms of embracing research, being proactive, like you said about it?
So if we look at the way research is now being conducted in other fields and in ours, I believe at this point, we're seeing much more detailed offerings, whether we think of them, you know, epistemologically as more objective or more constructive, almost isn't the point. The point is, are we communicating coherently, and does our research cohere? I believe that the material is ripe, the vehicles are strong, and because of that, it's a great time to get out there and do research that you're passionate about and find those particular vehicles that work for you to make things happen. I think it's a wonderful time in our field where we're seeing people not only demonstrate to our field how effective we can be and what meaning we create for our clients, but I think that we're beginning to show other fields very strongly the same thing. So I can only encourage everybody to get involved in whatever ways they can.
And the part about the other fields too, I might even circle back to what you started with in the first couple of minutes, which is the interdisciplinarity and the idea of, you know, really starting to work together, even across professions too. So I think that's a particularly salient point. Bill, I appreciate the time very much. Thanks for joining the Music Therapy Research Podcast here. And I absolutely promise that I won't auto-tune any of this. I won't degraded in any way. I want to make sure everyone's getting good, solid information, and I'll make sure none of this gets back to Dr. Colwell. And I'm sure you'll graduate with ease. Because if there's one thing I know about doctoral dissertations is that they're really simple. They're a dime a dozen. Shaquille O'Neal has a doctorate. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah. Every now and then when you start feeling too good about yourself after you complete your doctorate, something will pop up on the news where you go, that guy's got a doctorate, and that'll be a good motivation for you to go back to research and go, oh, I know I've got a doctorate, so does Shaq. I better go do something else now. you have to somehow differentiate yourself from Shaq. So that's what I think I'll leave our listeners with. Bill is going to differentiate himself from Shaquille O'Neal.
Well, you know, the hair's not going to help, but we'll see.
Well, we're already pretty close. I'm looking forward to seeing you at conference. Thanks very much for the time, Bill.
Thank you.
These days.
Music for today's podcast is These Days by Robin Gray.
There's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you. These days.
This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast, associated with musictherapyresearchblog.com.
Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. Follow MTRB on Facebook and your hosts on Twitter to stay up on all the music therapy research we send out into the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance. Also, send in a comment about the podcast on the contact page at musictherapyresearchblog.com.